You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. Putting a one-room play onto the screen, Alfred Hitchcock looks to add a new dimension to the murder thriller Dial M for Murder, and we will discuss it this week on Zach on Film.
Hey, good job on that intro, Zach, because
hey, you
pretty much covered everything that are your main talking points of Dial M for Murder.
Let's go home. We're done.
Dial M for Murder, adapted from a stage play.
Yeah, it really feels like... I can't remember if I actually read it before I watched the movie... I probably did, otherwise I might not have thought of it. But it felt like a play. It felt like a one-room play. Because probably, 90%, 95% of this film takes place within a one-bedroom flat.
Yes. And in the main living space. You never go into the kitchen.
I don't even know if there is a kitchen in this apartment.
Yeah, there is, because they open up the door. He comes out one time serving tea to the cops.
Another time,
he opens the door and says, see, there's bars.
A lot of plays, can move into the kitchen, but they literally, like this is what they do in plays, right? It's like, as you can see, there are bars in the windows here.
And we go into the bedroom once.
Go in the bedroom once. We look outside the apartment into the stairway and the open
And then we have the events that take place at the party where he's calling her.
Right.
Yeah, that's about it.
Yep.
Which is interesting because, wow, what a terrible, this is like, I know Hitchcock was working on another film and it went south. And then the studio's just like, yeah, sure, go ahead, make Dial M for Murder.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people really hail it as a great movie, but it's just like, okay, let's set up a camera and let's shoot this play. Okay, everybody go.
Yeah.
It just felt really lazy.
It's especially, when did this come out in
54.
Like the pedigree of 54. Hitchcock? So this is
way before Psycho, way before
Search
all
on
of
a
that
train.
Stuff. Yep.
That makes complete and total sense because from what we've seen of Vertigo and Psycho especially, And Strange on the Train has some pretty technical shots also. Alfred Hitchcock really pushes the storytelling and audience manipulation through camera movement.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't Strangers on a Train in 51? I thought it was.
I'm looking up to see the list of things, but this is definitely before Psycho, because Psycho was really his last big
60.
His last big piece. So when we look at
The Birds came after Psycho.
Man.
Strangers on a Train, 1951.
Yeah. If we look at it, and I'm looking for the big list where we left off last time when we had Hitchcock, we had Mr. and Mrs. Smith came out in 41, Saboteur in 42, Notorious in 45, Rope in 48, Strangers on a Train, as Rodrigo mentioned, 51, Dial M for Murder came out in 54, and Rear Window, the movie that we're going to see here shortly, also came out in 54, which I think is even though it is also essentially a stage play that's shot, it's done very differently, and so maybe it's a good compare and contrast in this case. Dial M for Murder came out in 54, and a lot of people just mark this as one of the great noir type movies, and I don't know,
we've certainly seen better noir,
I think so,
and Zach on Film than Dial. It doesn't look like a noir film. It doesn't have that feeling.
Except that, it is dealing with very dark themes.
Sure.
Let's kill my wife so I can get the insurance money and I've got an alibi. They kind of set that up at the beginning of the movie where they're basically like, I have the plan for the perfect murder in Kansas.
What I thought was interesting about how they set that up was we're introduced to the wife and to her lover,
yes,
as the first people, and it felt like we weren't going to get a backstory. Just like, these people aren't supposed to be together. They are. Watch them do whatever. It was interesting that we didn't get a whole backstory about the characters, and then the husband comes on and goes on like a 10-minute diatribe about why he's going to do this and why he hates both these people.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just an interesting... I thought that was an interesting setup.
Feels like stage play.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, it totally does. Yeah, I mean, that's... to a certain degree, a strength of it when compared to modern movies, because a lot of modern movies are shot that way. You know, mm-hmm. if you're a fan of the long take,
yeah,
there's definitely a lot of that going on.
Well, and so this is
also because of that, though, some unmotivated camera movements as well.
We'll talk about that in just a moment. But just to compare, because when we watch Rear Window, when does that come up? Not in a while, which is a shame. But the thing is, Rear Window is essentially this movie done in reverse, where instead of being the audience looking into this apartment, this movie is shot from an apartment looking out into a courtyard and looking at all the other drama going on in the apartments in that courtyard.
Yeah.
And it's really a lot of times just single point of view.
The interesting thing about Dial M for Murder is that it really brings up, I think, a very interesting a point in filmmaking and storytelling, which is that your point of view character is going to become your point of view character. Kind of, you're going to start trying, like, as an audience member, you're going to start trying to empathize with them. And this is the character that we spend the most time with is the murderer.
Right.
He's the only one whose full motivations we know. He tells us his whole plan, and then the story starts unfolding. Like, the guy is going to kill his wife, and you're kind of rooting for nothing to go wrong, right?
Right.
Your point of view character.
Maybe you are, I suppose.
Well, your point of view character, like, all absolutely. Of the 100% of the tension is this going to get pulled off?
Yep.
Yeah, that's the
thing.
And
is he going to get caught? Which means, why would you feel tension if you don't empathize with the murderer?
That's what I'm saying. You do empathize with the murderer because you're kind of rooting for this murder to happen.
Absolutely.
Because he's your point of view character. And he does paint the wife as a pretty horrible person.
What this is, actually, not that necessarily anybody Zach's age is going to know what I'm talking about, but what this movie is an episode of Columbo.
Yeah.
Like, if you've ever watched Columbo, that's what happens. You see the murderer or whatever, the robbery or whatever happen, you know who the murderer is, and the whole movie, you are, like, kind of tensely rooting for them to throw off Columbo.
Yeah.
That's kind of what's happening here.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing and the why the tension is built in this story, and again, this is not Alfred Hitchcock written, this is directed, is the fact that the husband says, I've got the plan for the perfect murder. And the co-conspirator is like, oh, there's no such thing as perfect murder. And even the writer,
mystery writer.
Yeah. The person that she's having an affair with, it says, oh, no, there's no such thing as a perfect murder because somebody's going to make a mistake.
Right.
And so what engages the audience then from that point forward, both in a stage play and this movie, is where is he going to trip up?
Right.
And you almost miss the point where he trips up in this piece, unless you're really paying attention with the key switch.
Right.
Is there such a thing as being able to create the perfect murder? You have a plot for the perfect murder, Zach?
No, because I don't think about such things. apparently Alfred Hitchcock does, though, because what, Strange on the Train came out right before this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's two back-to-back movies of trying to pull off the perfect murder in his films. Which, I mean, murder is pretty much, I kind of think, Hitchcock's baby. He kind of just rides that train. Everyone's dying left and right. I don't know. If it was a perfect murder, we would never hear about it, right?
Well, you also need to watch Rope, I think, too, because it's also about
the perfect murder.
Perfect murder. Really? Well, yeah, because there's a dead body in a box during a dinner party.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
It's like Clue.
Yeah.
The thing is, like, the perfect murder would
be one that you don't know about.
Yeah, and would be hugely based on all of the circumstances surrounding everyone involved, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like there probably is a perfect, like, if by the perfect murder you say, could I get away with killing someone? Yes. I'm sure there's a lot of drifters and people who don't have any family members, mm-hmm. and people who are like, you know, the weird hoarders in their town that everybody's scared of, or like, or nobody wants to interact with, or whatever. There's lots of people on the peripheries of society that somebody could kill and nobody would find out, and then more importantly, nobody would care about.
Well, but again,
the perfect murder for a beautiful ingenue, mm-hmm. that becomes a lot more problematic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're saying if you kill a drifter, nobody cares about that person. Right. Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. I thought you were talking about hiring the drifter to go kill somebody just a drifter.
Right. So, yeah, what I'm saying is that's going to be dependent on who is being murdered, mm-hmm. what their connection to the murderer or, I guess, intellectual architect of the crime is. So is there a perfect murder? Probably. Could I come up with one? Only if I also got to design the persons of the play.
Matthew?
Well, it's a tridented point for me. First, the perfect murder is the one you get away with. Second, I'm a little nervous at how well thought out Rodrigo's thought process on this is. And third and most important, I'm not going to give you this idea, even if I had it. But I think that when it comes to murder as a concept in a story, yeah, I think that we could put together a lot of situations, but the problem is they feel kind of contrived in some situations. My favorite actually is another Hitchcock film. Have you guys ever seen The Trouble with Harry?
Yes.
It starts with a murder mystery where everybody thinks they did it. Mm-hmm. I kind of love that twist on it. And this does that to a point as well. I think story-wise, for purposes of making an entertaining picture and or radio play and or comic book, the perfect murder is one that gets your attention, makes you interested in either finding the killer, seeing the killer that we know get punished, or most importantly, seeing some sort of closure. Like say the character being murdered is played by Shia LaBeouf. You can end the movie right there. I'm happy. I'm gonna go home happy. I don't need to know who killed him. I can just go, yes, all right, we're fine, we're good. That's a mean thing to say.
There's this idea of if you as a writer can construct the perfect murder, mm-hmm. and have it all thought out on paper, then you've got a great story that's really going to engage the audience. Because the problem, and there's, and I was trying to track down the movie, I can't find it, but kids are in a film school and the teacher instructs them, come up with the perfect murder. Mm-hmm. And so throughout the movie, I think that they're constructing the perfect murder and then they're carrying it out to prove that it is the perfect murder. I think that's how the movie goes. But the idea is there are so many plot holes in these people that are killing their spouses or loved ones or strangers or whoever, that the killer is always going to be found. And the challenge that the instructor gives to the students is, can you devise the perfect murder? Because then you have something that the audience goes away either very angry with or very satisfied with, that the killer got caught. And I think, talented Mr. Ripley might be one of those that is an example of somebody that gets away with a perfect murder.
I think, weirdly, I think Double Indemnity is actually a movie that kind of has the perfect murder.
Yeah, yeah.
But only because of this, like,
law.
Yeah, because of the very complex premise of it, right? Mm-hmm. And if you consider, spoiler alert, the way to get to commit the perfect murder is first to go to jail for 10 years. I don't know how long she was in jail. Probably not 10 years. But yeah, it's like, then it does become complicated.
Yeah. And that's another good noir movie, if you haven't seen that, Zach, by Billy Wilder. And it's been remade a couple of times, I think.
I think I have seen something where...
I think Angelina Jolie or something is in one of the remakes. Let me look here.
I felt like
see.
I saw the beginning of a film one time with my dad where a girl kills someone, gets sentenced to death,
Yes.
And they inject her with the lethal thing, but it actually wasn't the lethal thing.
Oh, she doesn't die.
Am I thinking of something else?
There is a thing that if you are put on the electric chair or you're given the, you know, a lethal injection and it doesn't take, you get to walk away free.
Well,
this must have been something different because they're like intentionally.
That's not in the movie, but I mean, I think that's the way it's supposed to be in real life. If you are electrocuted and it doesn't take, you go away free.
One of the, and again, this is completely fictional. One of the plot points of Oz, the TV show set in prison, was that one of the characters was this nice old man who murdered somebody in a fit of passion 50 years ago. They electrocuted him. It didn't take. And he spent life in prison surrounded by these hardened killers. And he's just, hi, I'm Bob. It's a great moment.
I'm sorry. I said Double Indemnity. I meant Double Jeopardy, which is the Ashley Judd movie.
That's what I'm thinking of, Ashley Judd.
Double Indemnity is the one with the insurance policy, I think.
Yep. Yeah.
Mike TV was a fan of that one, as I recall.
So, yeah, this idea of can you construct the perfect murder that really is an exercise in can you construct a perfect story that is devoid of plot holes, I think is an interesting thing to toy around with, if not a bit morbid.
Sure.
Right. Well,
I mean, it is interesting in the film when we're getting down to the last part and the lover slash writer comes in and is telling the husband what he should do to get away with it.
Right.
Right.
To get the wife off.
Yeah, to get the wife off. To
plausible deniability in a lot
of. Yeah. It felt really weird.
It is. It's like, it's a really interesting moment. Like it's hard to explain, it's hard to describe this thing where a character that might be one of the most unique things about this movie, right? A character accidentally figures it out in the process of trying to incriminate someone else for the sake of someone else. Like I think it feels a little convenient. Contrived because he gets it bit by bit, right? Blow by blow, he gets the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Nothing deviates.
But it makes you wonder, though. Again, it's revealed that the writer and the detective don't know each other. Mm-hmm. But up to a point, until he's walking back into that building at the end and knocking on the door, and the detective's like, what are you doing here, kind of thing. It almost feels like those two are working in cahoots to really uncover what was really going on up until that point. And then they realize that, no, there's no connection between these two. Yeah. Because you're right. It seems so forced.
And it felt like they were trying to say, hey, look how smart this, like the husband is. Like, look how smart our main character is. That he actually did figure it out before even the person who actually writes the murder mysteries and how the perfect way to do it.
I don't think that they stressed enough that he was a murder mystery writer. They kept saying writer, but if they would have thrown in the word murder mystery writer, it would have hit it home a little bit more.
Yeah.
They talked just briefly a few times about, oh, you write about killings in your books. Yeah, that could be a lot of things.
Yeah.
I think that kind of was a little misstep in the story. But I was really disappointed in the method that this was shot to a point.
Yeah.
Except that you have to remember that this was one of the first movies that was using 3D technology.
Right. It felt like a slower talking early Kevin Smith film.
Yeah.
Is kind of what it feels like. And then you learn they shot this in 3D and you're like, what in the world?
3D.
Which would have been really weird because this is not a movie that lends itself to 3D, especially when you're looking at House of Wax and others that were the pioneer 3D films. This one, I mean, there are some depth moments in there, you know, where you've got some depth of field staggered out on the screen, but I just can't imagine.
Oh,
They didn't do any, you know, throwing spears at the camera or that metal storm thing where somebody rides straight up to it. When I found out this was shot in
3D. Vertigo would have been a better movie to be shot in 3D than this.
Or even Everybody Rear Window.
Puked. Yeah.
You can do Rear Window in 3D because he's doing, you know, the zoom effects and you 3D. But I didn't realize until you said this that this movie was shot in 3D, having watched it today for the first time, by the way. But I can't wrap my mind around it. All of the hallmarks that I expect from a 3D movie, not here.
It's almost like because Marvel and kind of the way 3D's been used in the major studios now is just to add that depth. It's not a whole lot of things flying at you. There's usually like one or two things where it's like, oh, look at that, whatever coming at your face. But a lot of it's just a depth thing.
Yeah. Now, today, I mean, so
the water in your face.
The process was called Natural Vision 3D. And Hitchcock, this movie didn't make a whole lot of money. It made $2.7 million in North America. Hitchcock said this in the about 3D. He said, it's a 9-day wonder, and I came in on the 9th day.
Yeah.
Meaning that he came in way too late for this process, almost like many, you know, what happened after James Cameron released,
Avatar.
Everybody's like, oh, yeah, we're going to jump on this. And everybody's like, no, 3D just really isn't the thing. And now people are having to really explore how do you tell a story with depth and also tell a story at the same time.
Yeah, it was really interesting when I was doing reading for this film after I watched it. I stumbled onto an editorial piece from, I think it was The Wrap.
Mm-hmm.
And it was blasting Roger Ebert, who Ebert was coming down on 3D and the way it was being used. This is about 2010 or 11. Mm-hmm. And the way that 3D was being used and how it's not, how it's something, it's just here. It's a flash in the pan. It's coming. Right. It's going to leave again. Just like it did multiple times before. And this writer is, I can't remember the title. It was like, why Roger Ebert is obsolete and why you should think so too.
Oh, I think I've read at least bits and pieces of that.
He was insane
before. Yeah. I don't know. This movie is not a movie that should have been in 3D.
No, that is a very strange idea.
It doesn't belong in that. This used a polarization process, which means each lens is basically polarized to the light at 90 degrees. So one eye is getting part of the wavelength and the other eye is getting the other part of the wave. And it just doesn't lend itself. I still think today that... Did you see Guardians of the Galaxy in 3D?
No.
Matthew, did you see it in 3D?
Uh-huh.
Did you think that it worked in 3D Guardians of the Galaxy?
I think that the parts of it that I recall being actively 3D were nice little fillips, but I don't know that it necessarily enhanced the major portion of the film. I like the beginning, the dance in the rain. That's the point where I remember the 3D really being a thing. And also Yondu's moment on Xandar. When Yondu goes all wah hot John Wayne on all those guys, that moment, clearly I'm like, yeah, the 3D kind of enhanced that moment. But really for me, it was just sort of a hat on a hat. It wasn't really something that detracted from the film at all. I was glad because a lot of times, you know, the 3D, I think it's going to be muddy and dark and weird. This managed to maintain the light and the color. And then a few moments, you're just like, oh, crap, that's flying right out of my head.
I think the last time I saw 3D was the first Thor movie. And I was impressed by the way that they used the 3D in certain sequences there. But overall, it didn't really add to the presence of I am watching something through this window on a screen.
Yeah. That's the problem.
Interestingly, so 3D becomes a thing and there's all these problems with it to a certain degree because... When you're just taking things and then throwing them at the audience, you know, it feels like a gimmick. You have problems. You have problems with transitions. You have problems with, like, even pans. It's like, oh, yeah, we want these plants to be up front. But what happens when they pan out of the camera? They just, like, cease to exist, right? Even though they're up here, whatever. So there's all these issues. And the majority of these issues are solved by just being like, okay, well, we'll just treat 3D like it's like you're looking through this window, right? Into this 3D world. And it's like, cool, but then what's the point?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't add that necessary depth.
The solution to the problem, how do we make 3D into something that's manageable, is to kind of make it a little more than set dressing, right?
Right.
I think the first movie that I saw where I thought I was like, oh, yeah, this was 3D done right, was Up. Mm. And that's how Up is.
Mm-hmm.
Up. There's almost nothing that comes at your face, even though there's lots of things that could have come at your face because there's like dogs in biplanes in that movie.
Yeah.
And the way that they handle it was to, do it. That's a weird movie.
Do you remember Viewmaster?
No.
Yes, I remember Viewmaster.
That's how I like that 3D.
Yeah, Herbie the Love Bug looked great in Viewmaster 3D. Yeah. Just stereoscopic.
Oh, you mean the little clicky thing? Yeah. I thought you meant like the... Because I was like, I knew there was a Viewmaster movie coming out.
Oh, no.
But I never saw it if it did.
No, I'm talking about the true...
Yeah. No, Viewmaster I remember the Viewmaster. Yeah, with the discs.
Yeah. It's basically the same thing if you go back to like the 1920s when they had the stereoscopic trick pictures. That's the same thing.
Yeah, but the thing is that they're creating depth away from your eye, not to your eye.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't understand that's where... And if you've got stuff that has parallax... That's what makes the 3D work in that depth. When I went and saw Green Hornet, I went and saw it in 3D because that was the only one that was available. Mm-hmm. And I just remember that they did this pan across or this track across this desk. And it's like the foreground objects were really right up against that presence. And then everything else was behind it. I was like, wow, that is really good. No. Oh, what did they say? Because yeah. I was distracted by
the 3D. That's the problem is that any time you actually start doing 3D, I feel like if you're throwing at your head, if you're creating weird distance, if particles are shooting out, okay, it's so distracting from the story. It's not adding to, it's not like a mm-hmm. camera move that's telling you something. It's right. not a light that's motivated or anything. It's just like this cool, fancy thing that, frankly, again, just makes ticket prices more expensive.
It is there to try to compete with video games, with right. their high 3D yeah. graphics. It's there to compete with Netflix, cable television, terrestrial television, your cell phone, yeah. your iTunes, whatever. That is why it exists, because they're trying to compete and find a reason to draw the audiences in, saying, this is something you can't get from your iPhone. This isn't something you can get from mm-hmm. your Xbox One.
And it became
this
clear.
Is only in the theater.
Yeah, it became clear that's what it was when...
Oh, that's what it was clear in the 1950s.
When they tried to push 3D televisions and 3D yes. sport, and those bombed. I don't yeah. know anyone who has a 3D television.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so now you're only watching movies in 3D in the theater.
Yeah. No.
And I don't even know people who actually just like, oh, I want to go watch the 3D. No one I know says that.
Sometimes I'm curious because I'll say, I think I want to, you know, if I could go back and see Guardians of the Galaxy again, and I mean, I could. I mean,
sure, it's still one.
I would like to see it in 3D. I would like to do a compare and contrast and say, is there anything from my personal point of view that added to that experience? Mm-hmm. I've seen mm-hmm. it in 2D. Let me watch it in 3D and see if there's something special from that. I'm going to bet no.
No.
I don't know if this has changed or just my own experience or just my own eyes, but like there's something about the meshing of the polarization stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That really blurs the action. It really seems to me that like 3D movies are like particularly bad about that. Yeah. But it might just be that like I think the last 3D movie that I saw was the first Thor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, blah, I don't know anything that's happening, you guys. Just because like when the action got fast enough,
yeah.
everything just blurred to
Well, and you have to remember that when the polarized lenses, you're losing some of the light
yeah,
that's hitting. You're so you're really having to boost up your projector.
Oh, man.
And if the theater doesn't want to boost up their luminance their brightness because of bulb issues, then it's going to be look dark and muddy. And
I just remember that's actually not the last movie that I saw in 3D. The last movie that I saw in 3D was Avengers. And there was something on the screen. There was a spot on the screen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And everything's in 3D, but there's a spot on the screen which
it's a stain.
Causes this like 2D mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. So it's like, have you seen that that drawing that looks like it's like a square tube? Like it's kind of like a tube that goes around, but then when you look at the other end of it, there's three tubes at the end.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. Like you look at one side of it is like 3D. You look at Kobe Smolder's face, half 3D, half 2D, and I was like, I am going to puke all over the person in front of me if that stain doesn't go away.
Yeah. No, and it doesn't.
And it didn't.
Nope.
I will say that the 3D in Guardians of the Galaxy worked for Widget, who actually has issues with convergence. We actually had to have a little bit of eye surgery when she was a tiny, tiny baby mm-hmm. because her eyes weren't pointing in the same direction quite yet. And so, you know, having whatever process they have now work for her where traditional, you know, 3D hasn't was kind of neat, kind of interesting at least. When we would take her to the eye doctor, the 3D effects never worked for her.
Yeah, some people can't see 3D. Yeah.
But this whatever version they use in Guardians of the Galaxy did work.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't know if it's something different or if it's just, you know, the particular glasses we had that day, but it was interesting to see her react to that. And I'm wondering if maybe that's not our market when, you know, we're going to make a movie in 3D.
If you're going to pull a kid away from Oculus Rift in the next 5 years, you're gonna have to figure out a better way
of drawing a kid
into the theater.
Nothing's gonna pull away from Oculus Rift.
I can't pull my kid. I cannot pull my kid away from freaking Minecraft.
Yeah.
Unless I say, hey, did you know that there's a Minecraft patch for your video game or for this show or something? Then he'll pay attention. So yeah, maybe we are the maybe we aren't the target market for 3D, but the if they're thinking that the younger kids are the target, they're missing the boat. But
babies love 3D.
Here's the good thing. Well, really, young children aren't supposed to watch 3D movies.
Yeah, that's an issue. It's an issue with the 3DS, and that's the interesting thing is that portable and television size 3D technology is available.
Mm-hmm.
The
3DS.
There's a 3DS. Even like at the Flying J's that we hit, on the way to Nerdtacular, there was at least one that just had a big screen and it just had like a 3D like Powerade mm-hmm. coming out of you. No glasses necessary. Mm-hmm. It just has that polarization effect mm-hmm. right mm-hmm. on it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically a 3DS type screen.
Yeah.
It's like you can see it right in 3D.
Yep.
So pretty soon, if somebody is putting their head towards it, then, you know, you're not going to only have it in the theater.
I don't think this is a medium for storytelling. I don't think 3D is a medium for storytelling. And certainly this movie, Dial In for Murder, is a perfect example of that. The 3D should be used to attract attention. You're walking past the refreshment aisle, and this big old bottle is sticking out going, Rodrigo,
like a giant 3D. Shark comes out and tries to bite you.
That'd be a perfect reason to use 3D for advertisement.
Sure.
But for engagement stories, I don't see it. I know there's going to be a lot of detractors to that. That's fine.
I think like the real interesting thing about what we've seen about 3D is that they were like, 3D is going to revolutionize everything. And like the way that they've gone to using 3D is in the most subtle way possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like the only way that 3D works without making your audience puke or taking you out of it is by meshing it with everything else, which is kind of like what happened with color. Right,
yeah.
It's like
or sound.
There were movies that were like blah 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 in your face, but then eventually you just make everything color. You mute down the colors mm-hmm. so that things look normal, mm-hmm. and then it's like, hey, look at that! It actually helps in storytelling. Now you don't have to have a character explain that this thing is red. Why is this book red? Like, nope. Now you can actually just see that the book is red.
Yeah. The nice thing though about 3D, nice thing about Alfred Hitchcock in accepting to use 3D in this movie, is the fact that filmmakers are not afraid to try new technologies if they think it suits the purpose.
Sure. And we kind of talked about that when we talked about Psycho and some of the other stuff, that Alfred Hitchcock seemed to be one to embrace the technology of the day, whether it be sound or like mm-hmm. putting sound, which just sounds crazy. Right, like, I'm gonna decide to put sound in my movies.
Yeah.
Or even trying 3D for Dial In for Murder, which got me thinking, we're kind of in this age where film stock is like an extinct species almost.
Yeah, in fact, the studios have had to get together and figure out a way to keep Kodak alive so that they can keep getting film stock. Yeah.
It's being kept alive by kind of like five filmmakers, like mm-hmm. Abrams, Nolan, Ryan Johnson, and Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
They're big proponents for film. They don't want to shoot anything else. They kind of refuse to. Tarantino called my generation stupid and some other big things at cons, saying he hopes that the next generation after mine will embrace true film and go back.
Yeah, what are all these hipsters like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg doing?
Yeah.
Idiots.
So I thought, do you think Hitchcock would have started shooting on some Red cameras or some Aris? Or
1,000%. No question about it. If somebody had gone on to Alfred Hitchcock and said, I have a way in which you can record your entire movie in one card... that is this big, he would have been like, all right, great. Like, I do not think that he would, especially because cameras nowadays can replicate the look of film so closely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they can replicate the look of film so closely, and that's about 10 times closer than they need to for the average person to accept it as film, right? People talk a lot about MP3s. Yeah. MP3 is a highly compressed format. If you want to listen to your music in the best quality possible, then you go and you get a wax cylinder and you listen to that, right? And, you know, you basically get vinyl. But for everybody who just wants to hear that new pop song, an MP3 is going to be good enough, mm-hmm. even though it does cut a significant amount of information out of a song. Sure. Well, for movies, yeah. it's not even that bad. It's not even that bad yeah. of a mm-hmm. drop-off. If you're watching a movie on Blu-ray, if you're watching a movie on a digital cinema screen, you are getting practically the film experience. It is almost, you almost cannot tell the difference.
Mm-hmm. You know, Hitchcock in Rope, and this is an interesting movie you should kind of take a look at too. Hitchcock uses these super long takes mm-hmm. where basically it's just, we're panning the camera around. And there are times when he reaches the end of a 20-minute reel where he does do a setup of the camera in a different place, but then kind of runs that camera for 20 minutes from that point of view and panning and zooming and dolling and all these other things that he needs to do to tell the story. Going to what Rodrigo said, if you went up to Alfred Hitchcock and said, "Hey Hitch, here's a GoPro camera."
Oh, yeah.
It will shoot 2 hours worth of video. He'll be going, "Yeah, give me it." He'd go back and reshoot Psycho with nothing but GoPro cameras in the shower scene. He would be able to do that. He'd be able to do it in one take.
First, he'd be like, "Do I still get to torture icy blondes for the entire shoot?" "Yes, Hitch, you're good." "Oh, right, I'll do that."
So, yeah, I think he would most definitely embrace digital technology. And the way that this movie, Dial In for Murder, uses rear screen projection for every outdoor scene.
Which is really weird.
God, it's just so... He would embrace digital technology where he's like, Alfred Hitchcock would approach filmmaking the way George Lucas approaches filmmaking today. Mm-hmm. Oh, we can go in and edit this and add this and put in a bunch of people standing around over here. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's do this solidly, but let's do it on the cheap. It's like, you know, and it's not, I think there's this idea that using cheaper methods cheapens your film. And that's not true.
No.
It cheapens your film a lot more, I think, to say put product placement in it or something like that, right? I mean it depends what you mean by cheapen.
Sure.
But I think this automatic idea that just because you're using something that's affordable makes it worse. I mean, a great example of kind of like the opposite mentality of that is like, why were so many indie movies shot in black and white, you know, well into the advent of color? Black and white film was cheaper, mm-hmm. but nobody was getting on those guys' cases about why they were doing something the cheap.
There are some perception issues though when you think cheap, because if you said, "Hey, I just shot my this movie and I shot it for $5,000," people are going to, "Well, it's going to be a crap movie." And certainly, if you were to show up on set with a little camera like this little palm camera that I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People aren't going to take you seriously. They're going to say, "Well, that's a consumer camera. This guy isn't serious about his work, so therefore we're not going to take this project seriously," and people aren't going to give their all. So there is this weird notion that somehow a bigger looking, quote-unquote, more professional gear makes the product or the project that much more important. Yeah. There's weird perception in that. Yeah. And when DV Video first came out, I was in Atlanta. And we went to Sony Electronics to go to one of their, they were hosting our monthly meeting, and they were unveiling basically their DV cameras, and they were showing them to everybody, and people in the audience were just freaking going nuts because they're like, "Oh no, you got to have these big giant cameras." And they're like, "No, we've been giving these cameras, essentially the VX1000.
Right.
We've been giving them to CNN reporters. They've been shooting for the last 6 months with these cameras. And the only thing that we've changed is we had to make the camera slightly bigger because of the weight.
Yeah.
Was too light. Lens. Well, mm-hmm. just the weight of the camera was too light for these photographers that have been used to a 50-pound camera they had to add a little bit more weight to it so it could steady it up. But they said, "You've been seeing this on television."
Yeah. It's really great to see all of that because it's great that we are now at the point where cameras are too small. Like they can keep shrinking mm-hmm. them. But it's like, for example, my camera that I use at my real world job, the lens is almost heavier than the camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
but it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be. The lens could be 10,000, like 1,000 times heavier mm-hmm. than the camera, because it could be even lighter than it is. Mm-hmm. But it's like, when I first got that camera, it was a problem because I kept like falling forward because I was used to standing a certain way because I expected the weight of the camera to be even. I've seen cameras that are that small that basically those new XLR type photo cameras that can just shoot video.
Yeah.
They can just shoot high def video.
Yeah.
Steven has one.
Well, I've got the I've got a Canon Mark III, Canon Mark II. I've got some GoPros. But the new Sony A7 camera, it's just, what the heck, man? I mean, it's a great looking camera, but it's like looks like a little consumer pocket camera.
If you want,
and the Blackmagic same way.
If you want to shoot that and steady it with your shoulder, you need to buy a mount for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've seen that before. It basically looks like if you took a shotgun's like butt you just empty it out.
Yeah.
So that it's just like the silhouette of it, and then there's like a little tiny camera at the end of it. That's what they look like.
It looks silly. Now, here's the other thing, and the whole point of this conversation is, yes, we can have really tiny cameras like this GoPro 3 that I have here. You can have a really tiny camera that shoots fantastic video. If you don't believe me, go over to GoPro site or go over to Vimeo, where people are posting GoPro videos nonstop, and you're going to see some magnificent stuff. Some of it you don't even know that it's shot with a GoPro.
You've seen it. You've seen any extreme sports type video from a point of view thing in the past, 5-10 years, it's probably a GoPro. Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure they use it in Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, they did. A lot of the New York scenes stuff, the Times Square chasing stuff. Yeah, yeah.
I think the entirety of VHS is shot on a GoPro, too.
The benefit and problem arises in that if I ever wanted to get an establishing shot, and a great way to get an establishing shot is to do a flyover of a city or the cars driving up into the mountain, so you're following the car up the twisty road and everything. In the past, you had to get a giant helicopter.
Right.
You know, I mean, you had to go get a helicopter with a very expensive mount, and you had to go spend a day shooting. Today, you can go get something like the DJI Phantom, and you can mount a GoPro to the bottom of it.
That's a drone, basically.
It's a little drone. Yeah, it's a quadcopter is its official designation, but I think people like to think of drone because it's unmanned. But now I can go out for less than $3,000, buy this quadcopter with the GoPro and the transmitter so I can view what the camera's doing. It's got a gimbal on the bottom which stabilizes it, and I can tilt it up and down to get the shot that I want. In fact, I've even got a software program where I can essentially program the quadcopter to go and do what I want it to do. So if I want it to fly to the end of the street, pause for 30 seconds, turn south and go that way for, you know, another half mile and then return and shoot that entire way, I can do it. And it's great for filmmakers because now instead of renting a helicopter for $20,000 in the day, I can go find somebody with one of these quadcopters and go get my shot in 20 minutes and be done and save myself a crap ton of money. The problem arises is that the FAA is basically saying, oh, things are a threat. And the FCC is trying to get into it as well, to where if I'm a hobbyist, I can go out and fly this around and do whatever I want with it. The minute that I go over to a car lot, a used car dealer or a regular car dealer, and say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if one of your shots for your local commercial has this flyover of all your cars? The minute I do that and charge for that, suddenly it becomes illegal for me to fly that quadcopter.
Sure.
And there's a lot of back and forth going on with the government right now and filmmakers, especially because filmmakers are like, you don't understand how this is going to make these movies cheaper and allow us to do a lot more if you release some of these silly regulations.
It's because the technology
is too new.
Right. People so you get the same thing. Like someday people will be driving around with Google Glass like devices while driving in their car and absorbing some amount of data in the process. Probably some sort of driving type app or something like that, where you can just see your speedometer in your eyeball and not have to look down. Right. It'll make driving safer. But right now, people are talking about that. Should people be allowed to drive while wearing Google Glass? Well, no, because the technology is too new. Nobody knows what's happening.
Right.
And you don't want to be the state where somebody dies because of that.
Well, and the problem is that there are people who, and this is the problem with any new technology, they use it for purposes that, I'd say use it for purposes it's not intended for. It's intended to fly around. But the problem is they're using it for purposes that can cause problems. So like Yellowstone and Yosemite National Parks have banned the quadcopters, even though that's a great place to shoot with the quadcopters.
All national parks.
Has it been all national parks?
Yeah.
Because people have been flying them and they are noisy, but they disturb the buffalo and the national animals, and somebody crashed it into one of the hot springs in Yosemite. And so people are upset about that.
Man, that'd have been awesome footage.
Oh, I bet it was. Well, not crashing into the
if it would have got
into the hot spring
in the middle air by a geyser.
Yeah, yeah, that would have been kind of neat. But I mean, there's some stuff. I mean, if you go online, there's some fantastic, beautiful footage shot with one of these quadcopters flying over Niagara Falls, and it's beautiful. But you wouldn't be able to get a helicopter that low without disturbing the shot. So we run into these issues where new technology is great, but because it is so new, people's initial reaction to it is always going to be
fear.
Fear.
Yeah.
And concern. And I in this case, especially because I've invested in two of these things, I'm upset because I know how to fly. I'm not crashing it into people. I'm not using it to spy on people, somebody in their backyard laying out sunbathing. I'm not going out for that. I'm doing it for real purpose. And of course, the other group of people who are upset about this are the people that do the farm sprays, the Dow.
Crop dusters?
Not crop dusters.
They do like
the actual people that like Dow chemical are against these because geoscience people have been using these to measure stuff from the air. And the first places that it made that they made it illegal to fly these was over farm property and feedlots because they didn't want people going out and doing that and saying, well, look what these chemicals are doing to the ground and those quality. Kind of things. So it's
our governor was just at a farm around this area talking with people who had a quadcopter and seeing how they're using it to integrate it into their farm business.
And he was okay with that?
I don't know how it turned out. I just know what happened.
He probably called it the work of the devil and tried to stone him or something.
You're always going to have people who fight that sort of thing because they're concerned of the impact that it's going to have on their business. I mean, there are people who are fighting real scientific evidence of climates and, you know, greenhouse gases and their effect. Yeah. Oh, I forgot to keep coughing. But, you know, it's like, and they're fighting it because it hurts their current immediate bottom line, right? I mean, you just hope that stuff eventually will fall by its own weight, right?
So the good thing is we saw Kevin Spacey, and we talked about this on Zach on Film months ago. Kevin Spacey got up in front of cable operators?
Some cable news, or not news, just cable TV something.
And was basically saying, hey, you need to embrace change that Netflix is bringing when he's talking about House of Cards. And I honestly think that if Hitchcock were alive today with his pedigree, he would be one of the people in front of these technological changes and in fact lobbying, almost like what Spielberg and Lucas came out and said a while ago about the movie theater going experience is going to drastically change in the next 10 years.
Well, here's the thing. If Alfred Hitchcock was around and making and still doing projects today, he would be on Netflix and also on TV and also in movie theaters because that man was so prolific. Like you couldn't stop him. Like he would be in your phones, on YouTube, on Vimeo. He would be everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
He made three movies per second.
All up in HBO.
Remember when Spike Lee shot that commercial on the iPhone? When that was the short movie on iPhone? Alfred Hitchcock would have been ahead of him on that.
There's that. Oh, was that thing that like
BMW commercial?
No, I was going to say that Ron Howard thing that was like centered around a camera, like shooting stuff on a camera and putting a movie together through that.
That online wasn't a contest, but it was just like an online experiment.
It was like, it was like you shoot a bunch of cool stuff and then Ron Howard is going to do something based on that.
Yeah, they just did that BMW commercial where they shot it all on an iPad and then edited it on the iPad inside the car.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say about Dial In for Murder, Zach, or shall we get out of here?
Let me look at the things I wrote down really quick. Notes. Nope. That's it. I would just like to say this episode is brought to you in part by Major Spoilers VIP members around the world. Thank you for your support at MajorSpoilers.com and the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. If you'd like to become a Bronze, Silver, Gold member VIP, that was words I didn't get right. Bronze, Silver, or Gold VIP member. Go to members.majorspoilers.com and sign up today. Thank you in advance. Anything else?
This movie is out on Blu-ray if anybody wants to get that. It came out in 2012. And if they want to pick it up, they can head over to majorspoilers.com, click on that amazon.com link.
Yes.
And you can purchase it there. We'll have a link right there in the show notes for this episode that you can click and get to that if you want to purchase it as well.
Absolutely. And next week, We will be talking The Day the Earth Stood Still. I'm going to assume the first one.
Yes, the very first one.
All
not
right.
The,
not the Keanu Reeves one?
Not the Keanu Reeves
one. All right. We're going to be watching that next week. Call him Jack on the show.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.